It is Monday, November the 6th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, President Trump in Tokyo with tough talk on North Korea and with Japan's response.
I think that Japan does see some changes happening with recent rounds of sanctions and just international pressure.
Also ahead, a mass shooting in the U.S. state of Texas.
An absolutely horrific attack. It's the worst in Texas history of a mass shooting style attack.
And the plight of Africa's migrants, plus music reflecting the times. Hello everyone, I'm Steve Norman. President Trump is on a nearly two-week Asia trip and is in Japan to get things started. He's been meeting with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and others. In his public comments, Mr. Trump has continued his tough talk about North Korea and stopping their missile and nuclear agenda. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty asked RAND Corporation Japan scholar Jeffrey Hornig if the tough talk about North Korea plays well in Japan.
It does go well in Japan. If Prime Minister Abe, in the weeks prior to their recent election, he was talking very tough on North Korea. In fact, he called the election claiming that North Korea was one of the issues he wanted to get voter readout on. And I think looking at the President Trump's visit to Japan right now, Abe is really looking for one primary thing, and that's to get ensure that there's a united front against North Korea, and also privately talk to President Trump and reassure that the U.S. will, in fact, meet its treaty obligations and defend Japan if, in fact, conflict would break out in the region.
Japan's Foreign Minister Taro Kono and Secretary of State Rex Tillerson discussed that now is the time to apply firm pressure on North Korea. A senior U.S. State Department official traveling with Tillerson said the pressure is having an impact. Is that the view from Japan?
I think that Japan does see some changes happening with recent rounds of sanctions and just international pressure. When I speak to people in Japan, they often cite that you see North Korean workers being pushed out of the Middle East now. You see some ambassadors from countries being expelled. And they look at that and cite that things are, in fact, changing, that things that we haven't seen in the past from North Korea are starting to finally pay off, and that maybe the international isolation is being ratcheted up a little bit.
One analyst is quoted as saying that from the point of view of the Abe administration, the personal chemistry that exists between the two leaders, Mr. Trump, Mr. Abe, is seen as an asset. She goes on to say that she sees it as paying off, including that the president agreed to meet with the families of Japanese citizens kidnapped by the North Korean regime. That's considered a very important issue from Tokyo's perspective.
Yeah, the North Korean abductee issue is something that actually Prime Minister Abe really made a name for during the Junichiro Koizumi administration. Abe was an official in that administration. He really pushed that. He has pushed that. He pushed it during his previous stint as prime minister. And so it's not surprising that with North Korean tensions being as they are right now, that he does want to keep the abductee issue front and center. The Japanese government still claims that there are somewhere around 50, maybe 60 unaccounted for Japanese abductees. But North Korea has acknowledged in the past that I think total somewhere around 12 or 13 that they did, in fact, abduct. But those have either died or they've been released. And so there's that gap between North Korea and Japan. And because of that, Japan really wants to resolve that issue once and for all.
After the election mandate that Mr. Abe received, does he have a free hand to change North Korea policy? Say the North Koreans fired another missile over Japan. Is it possible Japan may try to shoot it down?
Well, this gets into a tricky territory because Japan, while Prime Minister Abe did reinterpret the Constitution to allow for the exercise of collective self-defense, there are still some legal tricky areas when it comes to that and the fact that if North Korea launches a missile, they have to determine very quickly whether it fulfills conditions that Abe set out to exercise collective self-defense. And then if it becomes even trickier if Japan is the only country that tries to shoot it down, because it's hard to argue collective self-defense if Japan is the only one actually making an action. But in terms of capability-wise, that too is a tricky issue, because if it's an ICBM like we saw in recent months, Japan's ballistic missile defense systems that it has. It is a two-tiered system. It's questionable whether that would actually be able to knock down a missile at such a lofted trajectory that we saw. It would have to be a flatter trajectory for its capabilities to actually hit it.
Mr. Trump, of course, goes on to South Korea next, and then China, Vietnam, and the Philippines. What does Japan hope that this trip to Asia will accomplish?
Well, I think that they're really looking for President Trump to keep the message up about North Korea, to try to get all regional countries on the same page to ratchet the pressure up. And given that Japan does not have close relations with China or South Korea, although the South Korean relationship has improved, surprisingly, but given that they don't have those close ties, I think they're Prime Minister Abe would hope that President Trump could deliver the message that the U.S. and Japan are serious about this. They really want a unified stance on this, and that just trying to get everybody on the same page.
That's Jeffrey Hornig, a Japan scholar at RAND Corporation. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. A gunman shot and killed at least 26 worshipers and wounded numerous others at a church in the U.S. state of Texas on Sunday. It was the latest in a series of mass shootings that have plagued the United States. Texas Governor Greg Abbott spoke about the massacre.
For these people were innocently gunned down. We mourn their loss, but we support their family members. We appreciate the first responders and what they've done to help respond to this challenge. They are continuing in their efforts as they put all the pieces of a very complex puzzle together to try to provide their community all the answers they need and deserve.
A lone suspect wearing black tactical gear and a ballistic vest and carrying an assault rifle opened fire after entering the First Baptist Church in the town of Sutherland Springs. That's about 65 kilometers east of the city of San Antonio. The victims range in age from 5 to 72 years old. The shooter also is dead. And on his visit to Asia, President Trump today commented on the mass shooting.
We join hands, we lock arms, and through the tears and through the sadness, we stand strong, oh so strong. My administration will provide its full support to the great state of Texas and all local authorities investigating this horrible crime.
Austin York is a reporter and anchor for KRLD Television in Dallas, Texas. We asked him about the shooting and the man who carried out the attack.
What we're hearing is it's 26-year-old Devin Kelly, who at this point we know had been in the United States Armed Services at some point and was dishonorably discharged. We're also hearing from a lot of witnesses, and although this has not been confirmed by authorities, that a lot of the shooting was done by an AR-15-type weapon. I just got off the phone with associate pastor there, not at this church, but with another church who is right now at the scene helping a lot of the first responders and so on. And he knows many of these people. And he, it, like so many others, are searching for answers. Who was lost? What exactly happened? One of the most heartbreaking things he said was that many of the authorities are going to parents and asking them for pictures of their children, the latest pictures they have, so they can identify them inside the crime scene, because it does appear that several children were among the victims. So an absolutely horrific attack. It's the worst in Texas history of a mass shooting type style attack.
We also asked him about the course the investigation might take.
It's going to be, unfortunately, eerily similar to that of the Las Vegas massacre, in which they're going to now try to retrace the steps to find out exactly why this man did exactly what he did, what drove him to this, how he was able to purchase the weapons. When you're dishonorably discharged from the United States Armed Services, you're not allowed to have an AR-15. So how he got this type of weapon, obviously must have done it through some illegal means or whatever. How he got through this this weapon is going to be of utmost concern for them as they go on to this. But that's basically retracing his steps is what you're going to hear. And then, you know, unfortunately, they haven't even notified all the victims' families yet. So that's going to be the first step.
Austin York is a reporter, also an anchor at KRLD Television in Dallas, Texas. European Union says it intends to allocate $47 billion for Africa in its next budget. European Parliament President Antonio Tajani announced that plan last week. However, the EU has been urged to shed more light on how it spends emergency money intended to curb migration from Africa to Europe. International humanitarian agency Oxfam will publish a report next month that will call on the European Commission to boost transparency about its EU-Africa Emergency Trust Fund. EU leaders created that fund back in 2015. Reporter Josephine McKinney speaks with VOA's Kim Lewis about the EU announcement and the concern over lack of clarity about its funding.
The head of the European Parliament, Antonio Tajani, has spoken at a press conference talking about how much is going to be allocated by the EU for development and investment in Africa. And this is part of the European Union's approach to trying to stop the flow of migration that we've seen in recent years as people flee their countries, flee poverty and war and other issues, and try to reach Europe. Now, he says 40 billion euros is needed, and the current allocation of 3.7 billion euros is not enough. Now, he says words won't convince migrants to stay at home. We have to give them the chance to have a decent life in their home countries. But of course, there's plenty of debate about whether that really happens and where that EU money is being spent.
And also, I understand that Oxfam will be publishing a report where they're calling for the EU to shed some light on how it's spending its money. Can you tell us about this?
We've seen some media reports, in particular The Guardian in the UK, quoting Oxfam, saying it's very concerned about how emergency funding is being used to supposedly stop mass migration from Africa to Europe. Oxfam is going to call on the European Commission to boost transparency of what's known as the EU-Africa Emergency Trust Fund. Now, that was created by EU leaders in 2015 to stop the flow of migrants across the Mediterranean. Now, that fund has apparently made available around 1.9 billion euros so far for projects in 26 African countries. But Oxfam is concerned about the lack of clarity here and fears that some of this money is being used and repackaged as border security without any real investment in development in these particular countries.
Did Tajani give any specifics on how the 40 billion euros would be spent?
No, it's a little early for that, but it's certainly an indication of how the EU is committed to spending more to stop the flow of migrants. We've seen investment, particularly in Libya, strengthening the Libyan Coast Guard, and we know that that already is having a major impact in slowing the flow of migrants. So it'll be interesting to see where the EU intends to allocate this money. Incidentally, the number of migrants landing in Italy, the number of migrants is down 30% compared to the same period last year, and a 78% fall in the number of migrants arriving in Italy was recorded in October alone.
That is reporter Josephine McKenna speaking with Kim Lewis, who is host of the VOA program, Africa News Tonight. UN Refugee Agency is calling on governments to grant basic rights of citizenship to millions of stateless people who suffer from discrimination, exclusion, as well as persecution. UNHCR made that plea on the third anniversary of a 10-year global campaign to prevent, reduce, and eradicate statelessness. A story now from Lisa Schlein, who reports from the launch of that new report in Geneva on the world's stateless minorities.
The Rohingya represent the largest stateless minority group in the world. Although they have lived in Myanmar for generations, the government does not recognize them as citizens. They are forced to live on the margins of society and are denied the most basic rights enjoyed by Myanmar nationals. Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have fled to neighboring Bangladesh to escape violence and persecution. The UN Refugee Agency reports there are more than 3 million stateless people around the world, with about 75% of them belonging to minority groups. The agency's I Belong campaign to end statelessness highlights the reality that these individuals do not belong anywhere. Carol Batchelor is the UNHCR's International Protection Division Director. She says stateless people are among the most bereft.
If you live in this world without a nationality, you are without an identity, you're without documentation, you're without the rights and entitlements that come, that we take for granted, even just being able to gather here today, having a job, having education, knowing that your child belongs somewhere.
Progress has been made in reducing statelessness since the I Belong campaign began 3 years ago. Thousands of stateless people have been granted citizenship in places such as Thailand, Central Asia, Russia, Kenya, and West Africa. But the job is far from over. The UNHCR urges all states to facilitate naturalization for stateless minority groups that fulfill certain residential requirements, grant citizenship to children in the country of their birth, and eliminate laws and practices that discriminate against people on ethnic and racial grounds. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And a quick note from the world of sports. Shalene Flanagan, dethroned Mary Keitney on Sunday, became the first American woman to win the New York City Marathon since 1977, Keitney coming in second. Jeffrey Kamara of Kenya won for the men. Wilson Kipsang of Kenya finished second. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Ancient legend has it that somewhere in this world, there is a magic fountain of youth whose waters contain restorative powers that make old people young again. Now, a new study from the University of Arizona says, sorry folks, it's just not out there. Joanna Maisel, a professor at the university, and one of the two study authors, says aging is unavoidable. Researchers found getting old is logically, theoretically, and mathematically inevitable. Maisel says current understanding of evolution does leave open a small chance that aging could be stopped. But to do so, she says science will need to come up with a way to make selection between organisms perfect. And at this time, that's something that just isn't that simple to do. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. In our report from the music department, we reflect on Sunday's mass shooting in Texas and also the rash of hate rallies across the U.S. of late.
I could use a love song that takes me back just like that when it comes on.
Rising star in the world of country music, Maren Morris was born in 1990 in the U.S. state of Texas and has taken the world by storm with tunes like I Could Use a Love Song.
Feels like a trick that isn't working, but I haven't lost all hope yet. Yeah, it's hurting, but it ain't dead. I could use a love song. It takes me back just like that when it comes.
Morris is a singer, songwriter, and record producer, releasing four studio albums so far. Her 2015 extended play made it onto two Billboard charts, and her debut single, My Church, hit number one on the country digital chart in 2016 and reached the top five of the U.S. Hot Country Songs chart.
I've cussed on a Sunday, I've cheated and I've lied.
Morris is the reigning Country Music New Artist of the Year, was nominated for four awards, including Best New Artist, at the most recent Grammy Awards, where My Church won the award for Best Country Solo Performance. And just recently, she got worldwide attention when her song Dear Hate became an anthem. In the aftermath of several notable white supremacist neo-Nazi rallies, especially one where an avowed white supremacist used his car to run down and kill someone protesting the hate rallies. Dear Hate also features renowned country artist Vince Gill.
Dear Hate, I saw you on the news today. Like a shark that takes my breath away, you fall like rain. Cover us in drops of pain. I'm afraid that we just might drown. Dear Hate, well, you sure are colorblind. Your kiss is the cruelest kind. You could poison any mind. Just look at mine. Don't know how this world keeps spinning.
Whispered down through history and echoed through these halls, but I hate. In Dallas when that bullet hit, Jackie cried. He pulled those towers from the sky. But even on our darkest nights, the world keeps spinning round.
Yeah, powerful song, huh? Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Top World News is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday. Now a bit more from Maren Morris.
Love's gonna conquer.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S.-led global coalition has achieved great successes against ISIS on the battlefield in Syria and Iraq. We celebrate the coalition's gains on the ground, but, notes U.S. Coordinator for Counterterrorism Nathan Sales, we also have to be mindful that ISIS is adapting, and it's going to be up to us to adapt along with them.
Every square kilometer of territory that's liberated means women and children and men who no longer have to live under the oppressive false caliphate that ISIS has tried to construct. The success that we're having, though, against ISIS in Syria and Iraq doesn't mean that the struggle is over. It simply means that the struggle is entering a new stage. And that new stage is one in which ISIS might be sending operatives across the world to carry out attacks. Another related problem is people who may be inspired by ISIS to commit attacks.
Homegrown terrorism is a threat that is on the rise, and it is one that we are going to be focusing on, he said. The United States and its Global Counterterrorism Forum partners recently announced new initiatives to address threats posed by returning foreign terrorist fighters and by homegrown terrorists. Two separate programs seek to effectively assess the motivations and sympathies of returning family members and to explore the factors that drive people to become homegrown terrorists and identify them before they can strike. The United States and the Global Counterterrorism Forum also endorsed new recommended strategies to counter radicalism online.
Well, ISIS spreads a message of hatred, a perversion of the tenets of Islam. It's essential for us, and it's essential for our partners around the world, to counter that message of hate and intolerance and violence. So we have to work with not just other governments, but civil society organizations, religious leaders, community organizers, and private citizens who are in a position to effectively rebut these false claims.
The U.S. will continue to adapt and work together with its partners within both government and communities to realize a world that is secure against terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.